Okay, welcome back to the Constitutionals Podcast. I'm your host, Chad White. If you didn't know, this is the premier podcast for the website, cpluscomedy.com. Like I just said, it's a website. Go there. I was gonna hold off on this, but now I'm not going to. I'll give you a little hint. Okay, so I recorded the episode, and then I said at the end, I was like, maybe I'll put out the interview now or next time. And then I just said, yeah, I'll just do it now. So I'm putting out this interview now. I spoke to Jesse David Fox and Eddie Schmidt, who were the director and producer for Mike Birbiglia's Good One, a show about jokes, which premiered on Peacock on March 26th. Mike Birbiglia, he's one of my favorite comedians. I did try to get an interview with him, but that's neither here nor there. Mike Birbiglia, they did this entire special. I would call it a special. It's a documentary. But this entire documentary is about Mike working on new comedic material. It's based on Vulture's acclaimed podcast, Good One, which is hosted by the aforementioned Jesse David Fox. This doc chronicles the captivating process of a comedian crafting new material. I'm making a couple of jokes in here in this interview. It was pretty funny. One about Mike Birbiglia's sleepwalking. That's how you know I'm a fan! People included in the documentary commenting on comedy and Mike and all that stuff as a whole include Atsuko Akatsuka, Hasan Minhaj, and Seth Meyers, who I also tried to get an interview with, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not angry. I'm not angry at all. I have a smile on my face. It sounds like I don't. I can't wait to sit down and watch this. Full disclosure, I have yet to watch this. Eddie Schmidt directed it. It's a special. It's 45 minutes. Yeah, it's a doc. It's a special. I was right. Mike is truly, he might be my favorite comedian. I'm looking at the camera and I'm not recording video for this. But I'm so glad, I didn't get to talk to him. I'm so glad to have sat down with Jesse David Fox, who also wrote a book about comedy. And I'm so glad to talk to Eddie Schmidt, who has directed a good amount of comedy things, or documentary things, excuse me, including Chelsea Does, if you remember that show. I definitely remember that show because I watched a little bit of it. And Ugly Delicious, he was an EP on that. And Gilbert Gottfried's doc, Gilbert. These people are all over the place. I love it. Check out the special or documentary over on Peacock right now. I know I will. I promise after I watch the rest of a different comedy special that I started a couple of weeks ago. I put things down really quick. And check out the special. Check out Mike Birbiglia. Check out Peacock. Check out the Vulture Comedy Podcast. Good One, a show about jokes. And check out the rest of this episode following the interview, which includes me, which includes Jesse David Fox, which includes Eddie Schmidt. Okay. I'm going to throw to it right now. Hey guys, thank you for joining me, Jesse, Eddie. I very much appreciate this.
Well, thank you for doing it.
Yeah, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Of course. I guess I want to start with Eddie. This is a very big project, at least in my eyes, to the very least. Uh, and How I'm I guess the my biggest thing is, how did you approach starting to direct this big project and making sure things come off sincere and funny and like even have teachable learning moments for the audience?
I have a great love and respect for comedy and comedians, and I really, in all my documentary work, you hope to create a comfortable and safe space for people to express themselves. So, comedians, of course, have a great BS detector. So you especially want to make sure that, you're approaching, their world with genuineness and authenticity and curiosity. And then you feel lucky when they open up, and when people want to let you in. And I think the result is, as you mentioned, teachable moments, that you get an incredible look at the process of crafting comedy.
And Jesse, as a producer on the project, but also somebody who wrote a book about comedy and does a podcast about comedy, where did your eyes come in on the project, and how did you want to make it something that can be accessible?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think my perspective on it is that as a person who sees a lot of comedy, I feel like I have an insight and a perspective on what it looks like when people are working on material, and I sort of have a fascination and love for that. I find that to be kind of the most special part of stand-up comedy. And so when Mike got involved, or I was trying to figure out like how can we make sure we capture whatever that would be and have people understand what the work goes into it without sort of like weighing it down with like literally seeing a person writing in a journal for like 45 minutes straight.
Yeah, I think that'd still be that'd be good. That's kind of what podcasts are now, is just people going, shooting the shit back and forth, and then someone going, "Oh, that's a good one. That'd be a good bit." What were there? Did either of you take any inspiration from any other comedy documentaries or long form versions of comedy projects in order to help make this, or did everything just kind of come together organically?
I think there are some great documentaries about comedy, certainly. Many are, looks back, right? They're historical in a sense. They're looking at a comic who's passed on, or and looking at their body of work. I think what excited us was to kind of get in there and, film something as it happens. I love cinema verite and capturing, things as they unfold. So I think that was exciting to come in at a pivot point for a comedian trying to figure it out, as opposed to, either celebrating a great success or at the end of their career.
Yeah, and I would add that, when Ed, very early when Eddie I spoke, we talked a lot about food documentaries and not comedy, because again, we felt the comedy documentaries has fallen to a pattern. It was a lot of talking heads and a lot of clips and stuff, where we felt there had been developed a vocabulary with food documentaries where you're really seeing people work in a way, and you see how ideas come together. And Eddie has experience in food docs, and we're like, hey, what would be like that for comedy? Can we see how minds work and get in there, and not have it just be sort of like a person talking directly to the camera, then some footage of them performing X, then another person talking to the camera performing X.
It's I think one of the bigger issues with, not issues, but one of the bigger steps to overcome when doing a comedy documentary or just a movie about a stand-up is when to include jokes and how to include the jokes, and knowing that, like for this one, it's Mike building a set and having that be something that people need to understand, that this isn't the finished product and you're seeing the skeleton before we put the meat onto the human, if that is how our good Lord makes people. At what point do you, Eddie, to take things out and decide to show what or decide not to show? How does that help you as a director, and how do you want to work that for Mike?
Well, I think, in the show, the it's sort of at its most exciting when sort of the joke that, you know, a joke that Mike is working on or doing on stage is then explored behind the scenes and also dovetailing with his life, right? When those three things are all in sync, it's really pretty exciting. And so it became clear to us, you know, watching him work out new material, oh, these jokes, the ones that are personal in different ways, or the ones that are, you know, let's say craft driven in different ways, just fit into the story that we were interested in, you know, with this nexus of process and personal. So they kind of revealed themselves, you know, pretty clearly to us, I would say.
Jesse, as somebody who talks to a lot of comedians or comedy adjacent people, like you talk to Bassem Youssef or Hasan Minhaj and every other manner of comedian, and you write about them as well. Do you have has comedy kind of lost its luster, or do you ever find that you're examining things in such a way like this documentary? You're looking at the building blocks and going, this is how the joke works, and I understand it, and it's funny to me. Or can you just let yourself laugh at any moment?
Yeah, I would say sort of the opposite. I don't know if I can continue to do that if that was the case. I think I find myself, because I think I am able to watch comedy on a deeper level because I have an understanding of how certain things are happening or how complicated things are or when things are special, that when I do feel like a comedian is doing something exciting, I'm able to laugh quite a bit. I do think, if anything, I've become more impatient with worse comedians, or more, not even worse comedians, I understand people are developing. I think I've become more impatient with people I think are approaching it cynically and kind of not doing things they're interested in, but are doing things that they think might make them famous or get them, you know, a certain sort of attention. And that I have a very low tolerance for that. Mm-hmm. But if a comedian's like approaching their audience with an open heart and open mind, and the audience is doing the same, I'm very easily able to get on board.
You're right. Yeah. With Mike, I've seen everything he's done, and he's now kind of just transitioned into a comedic TED Talk speaker, where he's telling hour and a half long stories that all intertwine, and the jokes are there. But there's also a lot of heart, which really works for him because he's a very sincere person. But then there's, you know, as you said, other cynical comedians who aren't very funny in cases that I've seen a lot. And they rely on crowd work and they want to get famous on TikTok. And that's their whole thing, shtick. You know, as a producer, as a director, how do you fit in this new world of crowd work? I know Mike doesn't do it explicitly, but how do you fit in this new world of crowd work into an audience that kind of almost expects it at this point, because that's their version of comedy now?
Yeah, I mean, I would personally say there's always been a thing like this, right? Whatever crowd work videos represent now, there's been a version of that throughout the entire history of comedy, of something that comedians see that they can do as a way of sort of bypassing the process of working and building an audience more organically. And I think if anything, my goal is to try to push back upon that force as much as possible and just be like, this is what it looks like when people are putting more work into it. This is why it is special, and trying to teach younger audiences or people with less familiarity with comedy this sort of vocabulary of understanding why something might be better than the other, and understanding why maybe some of these crowd work clips are not really as complicated or hard as they seem, and you're basically seeing someone doing a fairly easy magic trick. Not to discredit all crowd work comedy, but I think a lot of it is just sort of like trying to build a more savvy audience. I like to say there's this Papa John's saying is better pizza, better ingredients make better pizza, and I say better audiences make better comedy. I think comedians respond to an audience that is demanding more of them.
I like it. Do you have anything to say about that, Eddie?
Oh, I was just going to bring it back to food docs and tie Jesse's metaphor together and say better audiences make better pizza, but I don't think that tracks. So.
Well, guys, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I very much appreciate this. This is a fantastic chat to get behind the scenes of comedy. Yeah. But I just want to say a quick thing. You know, it could have this doc could have been it's great. It could have been so much better if we got some behind the scenes look at how Mike goes to sleep and you catch him sleepwalking, climbing out of another window, crashing through. I think it would have been fantastic if it just turned into an office style doc.
It was disgust.
It was.
That's all we can say. It was disgust. It is a lot to ask to, can we film you sleeping?
Without the sleeping bag, without the restraints, without anything, that would have been great.
Oh, that we definitely couldn't do. Hey, can you risk the life for our doc? I think we really respond to it.
All right, guys. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye. And welcome back to the Constitutionals Podcast. I'm your host, Chad White. If you didn't know, this is the premier podcast for the website cpluscomedy.com. Like I just said, it's a website. Go there. Welcome in episode 287 of the podcast you forgot you're subscribed to. Like I said, I'm your host, Chad White. My voice is about 5 octaves higher. It is because of the pollen, and I'm dying. I'm slowly dying. I've had a sore throat, buddy. I've been dealing with those two, and on and off, I've had the ability to breathe, or not breathe. It's been tough going. We're gonna get through it. I just came back. Yes, I was on my bike. I used my bike. Just came back from seeing the movie Monkey Man, starring one Dev Patel. Monkey Man. It was it's a thriller. It's a movie where it was described as John Wick, but Indian or something like that. I would not describe it as that. Dev Patel said in an interview that he said action movies have kind of been put into, I'm not using his words, but put into this place where it's just like mindless nonsense, and he wanted to put heart into it. And boy, howdy, did he put heart into this movie. I mean, there is a story. The story is when he was a child, his mother was killed during a police. The corrupt police were taking over his the lands that his family owned in the forest. And now he's an adult and he's seeking revenge. The action is very strong and brutal and intense. And but at the end, there's the action sequences toward the end are just amazing. Anyway, they called it John Wick in Mumbai. Now, apparently, this was supposed to be released on Netflix. And it was made after the pandemic. It was supposed to be made in 2020, but it was made after the pandemic. And then Netflix bought the worldwide rights for $30 million in 2021. And then Jordan Peele saw the movie and then said, we got to put this in theaters. So through his Monkey Paw Productions, and through their distribution deal with Universal, they bought the rights for the movie for what it says here, under $10 million. That's crazy. I mean, that's amazing. And now it's in theaters, and it's probably going to... I hate to talk money and box office and all that, but I hope it does well, and I hope it does better than The First Omen, which... I can only assume won't do well at all. I don't know. I don't read Rotten Tomatoes or any of that stuff. And also, I didn't know The First Omen was coming out until today. But David S. Goyer produced it. That's pretty good. And it looks like they have a director whom I've never heard of. But good for these people. I just want movies to do well. Who cares? But I think Monkey Man is just amazing. It's a fantastic movie. What else is going on? Not much. Just been trying to deal with the just playing games, watching movies, all that stuff. Let's get into the story, because I'm slowly dying. This first one comes from The Hollywood Reporter, written by Alex Weprin. YouTube brings multi-view to Coachella live streams in major expansion. So YouTube's been showing Coachella live streams for the past, I don't know, I think maybe a couple of years? Oh, 12th years. Oh, my God. This is the 12th year it's been doing it. Hulu's been doing... Oh, God. Hulu's been doing a live stream of a concert. It's not Coachella, obviously. It's the other one. It's another big... Bonnaroo. Who's been doing Bonnaroo for the past couple of years? So that's the one that's been doing it lately. My voice is like... It used to be deep. It's like that episode of Friends where Phoebe gets sick and she can... And now she's a good singer. And then at the end she gets better and then she wants to be sick again because she was a good singer. Now she's not a good singer, even though she's in the regular voice. This is no benefit for me. I feel like a child when usually I have this deep sound and resounding voice. MultiView is a tool, a program, I guess, that was introduced with YouTube TV for sports. And it was introduced during this past football season, the 2023 football season. And unfortunately, it's been slow rolling out. You can do it with baseball, you can do it with basketball. I think you can do it with soccer. I don't know. I think you can do it with any sports on YouTube TV. Unfortunately, it has not expanded out to the rest of the service. I don't know why they're not doing that. I mean, if they want us to, for YouTube TV, in order to get 4K, you have to pay another subscription price for it. So on top of the $73 per month, you also have to pay, I think it's $10. It used to be $15, and I think they dropped it down. I don't know the prices, but I know now it's $10 just to get 4K and just to get offline viewing, things like that. But if they really want to build value into that, because how often, if I'm going to be flying on a plane, I'm just going to have Netflix, I'm going to have Disney Plus, I'm going to have my movies on Movies Anywhere or on Vudu or Apple TV, I'm going to watch that stuff as opposed to going, boy, I got to catch up on this censored Blade rerun. I say that because I wanted to watch Blade, and it just so happened. This is like the beauty of subscribing to a lot of things, which is unfortunate for myself. But I can just go. This happens quite often. I go, I want to watch this. It's not available anywhere else, but it's going to air on FX in 2 weeks. I want to set up a recording, and that's what happened this week. Blade was playing at some point this week, and as well as Blade 2 and Blade Trinity. And I was like, might as well. Do I want to watch those in their regular glory of the R-rated glory? Sure, I do, but they're not streaming anywhere. And I don't know why Disney does not pick those up as well as Daredevil and Elektra. Ben Affleck's Daredevil and Jennifer Garner's Elektra. Anyway, MultiView should be a part of that 4K package, just so that there's an incentive to spend $10. Because 4K streaming of a sport, sure, it looks somewhat good, but it's not going to be exactly good because it's not always broadcast in 4K. It might just be upscaled 1080p. And also, they might not have 4K cameras for a baseball game. MultiView, bring it everywhere, please. So the streaming for Coachella will be kicking off on April 12th at 4 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, which is 7 p.m. The good stuff doesn't air until like 10 p.m. Eastern, which is like 7 p.m. their time. 10, 11, 12. That's when you'll see people that you really like. Oh my gosh, Dua Lipa's playing. Oh, Tyler, the Creator. But then you'll be going to bed. At least I will. YouTube has made live events a strategic priority with his multi-billion dollar bet on Sunday Ticket, a big part of that, but it's been framed as a larger flywheel of the play. This comes from Ali Rivera. My voice is, I'm dying. I truly am. Ali Rivera, who leads YouTube's live music and artist partnerships business, says, bringing MultiView to Coachella is a great example of how our work on NFL Sunday Ticket will benefit all users across YouTube. The feature was first launched on YouTube TV for March Madness last year. Excuse me, it was launched for March Madness in anticipation for our first season of NFL Sunday Ticket. So that's where I got the football thing from. And now we're making MultiView available to global audience across YouTube, bringing fans to Coachella experience with their guys. Now, here's another story that connects to this. Will Shanklin over at Engadget says, who exactly is YouTube's multicam Coachella for? He says, maybe I'm of the wrong generation and have too long of an attention span, but who wants to watch an artist set without hearing it? That's what will happen to the three stages you aren't listening to. Wouldn't it be better to ellipses? Don't do an ellipses. Don't ever write ellipses. Watch what you're hearing. And then catch up on the others on demand when you can still listen, when you can listen to them as well. Okay. He goes on to say that sports makes sense because you can watch, you know, one game, one basketball game going on and another basketball game going on. The difference is for a Coachella, if there's four stages going on and there are any number of acts going on at the same time, there's not going to be one act going on at a time at each stage. There's going to be two or three going on simultaneously. And each stage is different. One stage is the electronic stage. The other one's like pop. The other one's indie. The other one is going to have the A-listers or what have you. There have been so many times, especially let's go back to Bonnaroo for Hulu. There have been so many times where someone's been playing on this stage and their set is bleeding into this other set. And I want to see what's going on. And it's going to be good to bounce back and forth. I'm back at the Hollywood Reporter. YouTube's Coachella products will place a special emphasis on the big living room TV experience. They talk about YouTube watch times and how that's a gross to over 1 billion hours daily on the TV, excuse me. There's going to be features like shopping and live chat, so fans can engage more deeply with Coachella no matter where they are on whatever device. I don't like that. I'm not a fan of live chatting. I don't think I need to talk to people. Not like I post online anyway. Okay. This I love this idea for MultiView. I know it seems kind of millennial, Gen Z-ish to have a short attention span and not be able to pay attention to what's going on directly in front of you. Yes, we're on our phones and on our iPads and on our devices while something is playing on TV. However, MultiView is merited in this case, and I just love the idea of being able to bounce back and forth between sets. Like, what if The Weeknd is on 11 p.m. Let me look. I don't want to throw out any more what ifs. Coachella 2020 Coachella lineup. Oh, it's a good lineup. I saw Renee Rapp, Lana Del Rey. All right, let's go to the lineup. Let's go by day. So, give me the schedule. So, here's Friday. Let me just name the people I know on Friday. Brittany Howard, Chapel Roan, Chloe, Deftones, Faye Webster, Gorgon City. I'm not saying I like these people. I'm saying I know these people. Honey Dijon. Let's see. I want to keep going. So any matter of these people, Lana Del Rey is on Friday. Lil Uzi Vert. So any Peggy Goo. Sabrina Carpenter. I mean, Skepta. Come on. any of these people could be playing during someone, the Japanese House, the best, Suki Waterhouse, Tinashe, any of these people could be playing during someone else's set. And yeah, I mean, you could watch it in the reruns, but who wants to sit? That would require you having to go back, go to a different stream, go back and return, go back to the where they were playing it. You know, that's how TV works. Anyway, I don't agree with this this guy over at Engadget, but to each their own. All right, this next one comes from Variety. I'll admit I have not read this one. Rebecca Rubin and Brent Lang wrote this. Film fans keep splurging on Blockbusters and IMAX, so why hasn't Wall Street gotten on board? I had to see, what's that movie called? Oppenheimer. I had to see Oppenheimer in IMAX 70mm. I had to. The only place that was playing both IMAX and both 70mm on the same screen was at the Mall of Georgia, which is about an hour north, south, east, west. Which highway did I take? Northwest of the city. It was an hour away. Let's just say that. Northeast of the city. One of those. I had to, and I had to drive. We had to drive and go see the movie the way we walked it. I had my edge seat. I need my edge seat. But when that explosion happened, first of all, it looked amazing. But when that explosion with the atomic bomb happened, it was so dang quiet in this theater. I mean, oh my gosh, it was so quiet. And then the ripple, the shock waves hit us in our chest, deep in our chest. I have a cold now. It felt like I had a cold then. And that elicited so much joy from me. It was a fantastic feeling to go see that movie like that. But prior to that, this wasn't 70mm. I don't know if this was IMAX. But prior to that, I saw, what is it called? The Hateful Eight. That was a fantastic deal. I was still living in the suburbs. So me and my stepdad and I drove down here. I think it was January 1st. I think that's when we bought our tickets. We drove down here New Year's Day, watched the movie on the screen at Atlantic Station, a movie theater I do not like going to, but we watched it, and that was a fantastic, great feeling. Last week, I saw Godzilla Cross Kong in Dolby Atmos, and while that is not IMAX, I was happy to pay the big price of the $20 ticket. I had a $5 certificate for my points, baby. I was happy to pay because it was going to be big sound, big picture. It was going to sound and feel great. IMAX is a fantastic format. I love IMAX. And while I wish there were more IMAX theaters around me, not Atlantic Station, I'm not going up there. But while I wish there were more IMAX theaters around me, I will support that. We've got people like Tom Cruise and Christopher Nolan just begging and willing studios to shoot things in IMAX. Look at The Dark Knight. I mean, how many scenes of that were shot in IMAX? Look at the last couple of Mission Impossibles. You know when the IMAX is on because it goes from widescreen to full screen. Then look at Disney Plus. They put the IMAX movies on Disney Plus. I saw Doctor Strange Multiverse Madness in IMAX on Disney Plus. And I don't even like superhero movies. I saw it. I also saw there's another Marvel movie I watched in IMAX. On Disney Plus. What is it called? I don't know, it doesn't matter. But even Tom Cruise, he had to lobby to get Mission Impossible to a longer run. Nolan. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong thing. I'm sorry. The deal with Christopher Nolan meant losing out on playing Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, expected to be one of the year's biggest hits. At its most profitable venues, exhibitors in Germany were blunt, assuming the personas of critics. What? Are you an idiot? Why wouldn't you play Mission Impossible? I thought you guys knew what you were doing. Talking about how exhibitors had to choose Oppenheimer over Mission Impossible. Oppenheimer grossed $188 million at IMAX, just behind the first two Avatar movies, The Force Awakens and Avengers Endgame. Mission Impossible sputtered, ranking as one of the year's biggest commercial disappointments. I love the movie. I love the movie. And so did Joe Biden. I guess we're just two old men who love trains. Hey, this is my Joe Biden. Nope. It sounds a lot more like Bill Clinton. Hey, it's my Bill Clinton. Here we go. All right now. I did not inhale. Are we sure I'm sick? Oppenheimer and Dune Part 2. Oh, yeah, I saw Dune Part 2 and Dolby Atmos, which earned roughly 20% of their ticket sales from IMAX, demonstrates the force of the IMAX brand. When audiences go to the movies, they overwhelmingly choose to see films in IMAX. In the process, IMAX, with its sprawling screens and carefully calibrated sound systems, has become a gold standard for ticket buyers. I saw Spider-Man No Way Home. Is that the last one? I saw that one in IMAX. I drove to the suburbs with a friend who lives in the suburbs. We met at the mall, North Point Mall, and we sat down and watched that movie. I hadn't seen a lot of Marvel movies up until then. I saw a few, and then I sputtered out. And now if it's on TV, I'll just turn it on. Isn't that interesting? If YouTube TV, if I just need something on in the background that I do not need to pay attention to, I can go to USA or TNT and a movie is playing and I'll just press play. More often than not, it's because it's TNT and USA, it's Harry Potter, it's a Pirates of the Caribbean, it's a DC or a Marvel movie. Even as IMAX has become invaluable to filmmakers like Denis Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan, the company struggles to get respect from Wall Street. IMAX has 1,772 auditoriums, a fraction of the 250,000 screens worldwide, yet IMAX's share price has languished at roughly $16, which is down from more than $19. Maybe that's why I like it. Maybe IMAX should expand, partner up with, I know Alamo Drafthouse is up for sale, so maybe partner up with Alamo Drafthouse and just say, we're going to update. Maybe IMAX, and hear me out on this, I think maybe IMAX should look to partner with someone like Alamo Drafthouse or Landmark or Cinemark or whoever is around outside of AMC theaters, and who doesn't have the Dolby imprint, because I don't know if Dolby is just at AMC, and build smaller scale IMAX systems. Yes, it'll be great to have the all-encompassing IMAX around you, but also, wouldn't it be fantastic to emulate that same experience while you're in a smaller venue, in a smaller theater? When I'm at home, I have a sound bar. It's not the best sound bar, but it does have Dolby Atmos, and it sounds good enough. And I got an LGC one, and everything looks great. It looks fantastic. Why can't a movie theater, if IMAX is the other end of that, if IMAX and Dolby Atmos are the other end, Dolby Cinema, if those are the other end of that spectrum, and then movie theaters are, like regular movie theaters are, just the AMC's laser and then, you know, whatever projector system's at every other movie venue, why can't we make that better? Why can't we plus that up? How many mid-size, I'm gonna harken back to my old stalwart, how many mid-size phones, excuse me, mid-range smartphones are there. This is the Samsung 23 Ultra. But the 23 Plus, I think that's the middle one, is just as good as this. This one just has an extra camera and extra RAM. And I think a better screen. But you're still getting the same performance. You're going to get the same other four cameras or whatever. The same support. Why can't IMAX do that? 2025 is going to have sequels to Jurassic World, Captain America, Fantastic Four. The first Fantastic Four movie, excuse me. It's going to be able, it's IMAX is going to be propped up by these tent poles, which is unfortunate, because I would love to see something like Monkey Man in IMAX. They also have the ability to play the Paris Olympics concerts from people like Andre 3000 and Queen. IMAX is all over Asia. It was amazing. And apparently more than 20% of Hollywood's global box office in 2023 was from foreign films. Or IMAX's box office, excuse me. IMAX is up against brands like 4DX, Cinemark XD, and Event Cinema's branded VMAX. I don't know, I've never heard of that last one. I've heard of the first two. I've never heard of Event Cinemas. IMAX, their competition is good, and IMAX should be able to go toe-to-toe with Dolby at a cinema. I was going to say Dolby Atmos. All right, and this final thing comes from Rick Porter at The Hollywood Reporter. ESPN's standalone streaming service will be available through Disney Plus. This new platform is set to launch in 2025. So, we know ESPN is going to be its own streaming platform. We have no idea what's going to happen with ESPN Plus. I assume it'll be axed in favor of this. And we know that Disney has teamed up with Warner's and Fox in order to have a sports-only streaming product. But CEO Bob Iger said, during recorded remarks at Disney's annual shareholder meeting, that the standalone ESPN streamer is going to come through Disney Plus for subscribers who bundle their Disney services. If you looked at, I think I mentioned this last week, Hulu is out of beta on Disney Plus, so now you can access all of your Hulu stuff except for ESPN Plus live things. You can access all of that on Disney Plus, so now you can just have one app. At the same time, next year, we're going to be able to access, if you subscribe to ESPN, you're going to be able to access ESPN via Disney Plus, and it's going to be integrated in the same way Hulu is now integrated into Disney Plus. Because at first, Hulu was not integrated. You weren't able to go to Disney Plus's app and see. I'm going to scroll through. You weren't able to go through here and see, oh, there's a new American Horror Story. Oh, there's a Grey's Anatomy. You weren't able to see that until they got out of beta. So at some point next year, we're going to see 30 for 30 integrated through here. We're going to see, Stephen A. Smith's new show or whatever. Who cares? Oh, my package was delivered. Iger also reiterated that the standalone ESPN streamer will also feature a host of engagement points, including fantasy sports betting and e-commerce, because that's what ESPN is now. Those features will also help the standalone platform differentiate itself from ESPN, Fox Sports, and Warner Bros. Discovery Sports joint streaming venture that's slated to launch later this year, which means that if you are somebody who likes the betting aspect or the fantasy aspect of ESPN Plus, then you will go. You're going to be able, if you want to just get your sports stuff through that, then you're going to interact with that. But otherwise, if you don't want that stuff, then go to the other one. I think ESPN is going to be more than $30, more than $20 for sure. And I think that the Fox Warner Bros. ESPN thing, Disney thing, is going to be minimum 40. So that's what's going to happen. These things are there's going to be a lot of options, and I think it for company wise, I think it would be best for Disney to not make a mistake and slip up and go, well, more people are going to our platform as opposed to the one we make with Warner and Fox, then we should just not work with them anymore. Because you're going to lose people's trust if we're bouncing around from service to service. You want I think the point for this all is retention. Retention is the best idea. So why not fight for that type of audience to stay and be able to watch the show? But, you know, Disney's going to do what it's going to do. I wonder if they will ever. I think the timeline for the live stuff is going to come onto Disney Plus is going to be has been shortened, and I wonder if they will continue with the Hulu with live TV aspect, because it is not doing as well as YouTube TV. But I would venture to say it's probably doing better than cable than Dish and Comcast and Spectrum, the rest of that. Listen, if you like what you heard here, head to the website, cpluscomedy.com, where you can see me talk to your favorite people. You can follow us. You can watch video versions of every podcast, including this show, as well as Late Night Lately, which I'm going to record after this, the Late Late Night Show, which is the Late Night Show podcast, and LinkedIn Logs, which is the Jobs podcast. You can follow us on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at C Plus Comedy. And yeah, I think that's it. I'm supposed to put up two interviews, but I just so lazy right now. But maybe you'll find out who in a second. I'm kidding. You're not going to find out who. All right. Thank you for listening. And I will throw to the theme song earlier than expected. Okay. Bye.